and welcome to Pedagogzilla, the pedagogy podcast with the pop culture core.
Hello, I'm Mark Childs. I am imposter syndrome incarnate because I'm still standing in for Mike and I'm still trying to get all the buttons to work. And this morning I'm being joined by my capable co-host.
I'm Rebecca Ferguson. I'm Emerita Professor of Learning Futures at the Open University, and I am innovator of pedagogies. And we're joined today by two guests. Olivia, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Olivia Rowland. I'm the quality manager at Arden University.
And Alice.
Hello, my name's Alice Chapman, and I'm the product developer in the learning design team at Arden University.
Brilliant. The reason why we have two guests today to help us with the question is our question is on AI and how AI is involved with learning design. And our question is that we'll be trying to answer today, would an AI learning design have helped the Sorcerer's Apprentice avoid being swamped by workplace tasks?
Part one, the question.
Now, I guess we'll start off with talking about the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Does anybody want to sort of talk about the Sorcerer's Apprentice? Alice, you said you've got a music background, and I think there's a musical connection, isn't there? A really strong one.
Yes, there is. So there was a poem that was actually written by Goethe, and there's a French composer called Paul Dukas who wrote a symphony around it in 1897, and that's The Sorcerer's Apprentice. And a lot of people are probably familiar with it because it was in the 1940 Fantasia film by Disney, which was... just an incredible film in itself, I think. As a musician, I always loved it, especially when I was younger. But I find it really interesting. I think for me, one of the biggest connections with what we're talking about today is thinking about Dukas himself. He was actually very highly self-critical of his own work. And he actually destroyed a lot of his compositions before he died because he wanted them to be perfect. And I just find that quite interesting with the sort of spirit of our topic today. And I do wonder how he personally would have coped with AI creations. But yes, the music itself is fascinating. There's quite a different take on how it was written. So he sort of starts off with quite a basic sort of melody in a way, which he uses with the bassoons, and then he builds on it and builds on it. And the tempo continues to get quicker, and it's quite chaotic. And I think it sort of lends itself really well to the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
And you mentioned Fantasia, which is how I know it, because I saw Fantasia when I was a kid and was absolutely blown away by it. And also it would turn up on children's TV quite a lot as just a single musical sequence. So do you want to tell us about what actually happens in the Fantasia sequence?
Yeah, so in the Fantasia sequence, it starts off with a sorcerer, and you can sort of see him around his cauldron, and he's putting things in, and he's got his magical hat, and then he's got his apprentice, who is Mickey Mouse. And when the sorcerer leaves the room, he tells the apprentice he needs to clean up. So Mickey then starts to do that and is obviously a bit bored by doing the cleaning, as we all, I'm sure, suffer with when we're having to do our chores. But he then gets the broom, looks over at the hat, puts the hat on, and decides to essentially bring the broom to life to get water from a well. And so the broom starts getting the water and bringing it over and doing the cleaning, but it just completely gets out of hand because he falls asleep. And when he falls asleep, he's having this wonderful dream, and it's one of the best bits of it where he's sort of bringing these waves up and you can see them crashing up the sides. And in his mind, he's like, this is just amazing. But then when he wakes up, he realises that actually the broom has just continued doing the work, filling up the well, and it's overflown and there's water everywhere and everything's flooded. So it's sort of showing that he needed to keep his eye on it. It wasn't ready. He just keeps going with it. He breaks the broom in two and it splits, and then because he's trying to destroy it, and then it just grows and grows, and there's just hundreds and hundreds of these brooms, and it's just chaos. And then the sorcerer comes back, and quite sort of famously in the music, it sort of ends with these big chords where he puts his arms out and all the water sort of crashes to the side and he's able to walk through and he fixes the problem. Tells the apprentice off, takes his hat back, and that's the end of the tale. So yes, I'm sure we've got a lot of correlations that we can make with the AI piece today as well.
So should we just talk about what some of those correlations, how this feels like this is an AI type thing?
I think one of the connections is the sort of famous rule from Arthur C. Clarke that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So Sorcerer's Apprentice obviously working with magic here, but the rest of us working with AI. So in the beginning, the apprentice sees this as a very useful tool. Magic is really going to reduce the burden on him and make his life so much easier. So he can just sit back and relax and the magical broom can get on with it. He sees it as a way to generate helpers. And we certainly see that in AI and education being done. But he doesn't understand how it works. It's all a sort of black box to him, how this magic is actually happening. And more importantly, he doesn't know how to control it. He finds things scale up really, really quickly. You know, if you think how quickly 2 divides into 4, 4 to 8, 8 to 16, you know, you get huge numbers very, very quickly. I remember when I first saw The Sorcerer's Apprentice as a child, there was this real sense of peril as this huge amount of brooms just multiplied and multiplied, and it looked inevitable that Mickey Mouse was going to drown at this point. So you've got this huge problem of scaling, but in the end it increases his problems. It doesn't solve them. He hasn't seen through to the end. But I think we can also see some issues with the wizard. So the wizard has a powerful tool, but he's not protected that sufficiently. There aren't safeguards in place, and he hasn't done sufficient training with his apprentice. His apprentice isn't aware of potential problems. So those are some of the parallels that I see between The Sorcerer's Apprentice and I think particularly generative AI. I think we're probably talking about generative AI here rather than AI in general, do people think?
Yeah, and I was going to say there's one other parallel as well, which is the reason why Mickey doesn't know how to use it appropriately is because he's been banned from using magic and he helps himself to it without any instruction and without any guidance from the wizard, the sorcerer rather, because I guess the sorcerer's just decided, oh, it's too dangerous for him, I can't let him do that. All he's good enough to do is mop the floors, not actually learn to use any magic. That's something we might return to when we come to the second bit. Alice, were there any other parallels that you wanted to draw between AI and Mickey, or Mickey's use of the broom and the broom and AI and all that sort of thing?
Yes. Yeah, so for me, the area that I'm particularly interested in and sort of work within is inclusive design and embedding digital accessibility and sort of thinking about the lived experience piece and humanising design. You've already both sort of touched on that in the sense of the roles of the people within it. So the role of the sorcerer and the role of the apprentice. And I think that for me is a space that within the AI space, when we're thinking about things like lived experience, there's not the conversations around representation and the sort of bias that comes with AI. Those conversations aren't being had at the beginning, which means that and when you think of with the Sorcerer's Apprentice not having those discussions at the start around the importance of the human role means that people are just sort of going off and maybe using tools without having had that human interaction at the beginning to think about the output at the end.
That's just reminded me of something really interesting. So one of the ways that I guess I first started thinking about AI was when I had a job that was near Bletchley Park. I went to a really interesting exhibition there about AI and how it perpetuates bias. And I had never thought about that before until I went to that exhibition. And having been reading about AI, that is something that really concerns me. It doesn't seem to be something that is being discussed or addressed particularly. I read a very interesting book last year. I don't know if anyone else has read it, Empires of AI by Karen Howe. It's a very good book on the reasons why we need to be careful with AI, not just the bias to perpetuate, but the power imbalances. It's incredibly thought-provoking. I really recommend it, but it really focuses on how AI is magnifying existing power imbalances and magnifying, perpetuating these biases that are already inherent in most of what we do and that we don't think about.
So the biases are things like who's designed it and what the training date, what data it's been trained on and all that, which is, if that's white, male, Western.
Exactly. And there's, the perspective of the people whose content the AI is drawing from, which is another problematic issue as to how the AI is getting access to that, whether they should have done.
I think for me, the tie with that and the Sorcerer's Apprentice is whether we're talking about bias, whether we're talking about an issue with quality or best practice or just sort of poor practice in that sense, is that when that broom is split, this is then duplicated and is going out to the masses. And I think that's where the concern is, that the conversations, like the tool is very powerful and there's a lot of really good things that can be done with AI, but it needs to be looked at very carefully at the beginning. As you mentioned earlier about the teaching role of the sorcerer, the allowing the apprentice to learn properly before just going out and then spreading that best practice, or in the case of the broom, the practice of the broom, being able to do that, that's where there's an issue, and that's where I see the sort of tie coming in.
And there was one other question I was going to ask, which is, when we was a few minutes ago, Rebecca, you were asking, I assume we're talking about generative AI and not AI in general. And we all went, oh, yeah, of course. And I have to admit, I didn't understand the question. So what is the difference? What is AI? What is AI? What is generative AI? What are we talking about when we're talking about that distinction?
Yes, because that is really the second half of the question, isn't it? And we've sort of leapt ahead to assuming that everybody knows what we're talking about, I guess. So artificial intelligence broadly, we've lived with that for quite a long time now. And generally speaking, we've been fairly happy with some of the things it's done. For example, when we switch on our sat-nav and ask it to go from point A to point B, it's using artificial intelligence to do that. And occasionally it sends us down stupid routes or dead ends or into the sea. But generally speaking, we're happy with that sort of use of AI. The thing which has sparked the huge interest in AI in education, other areas recently, is the emergence of something called generative AI. Sort of triggered by the release of ChatGPT, which was a specific instance of it. And this is a technology that automatically generates content in response to prompts that you write in natural language. So you don't have to know how to program. You just ask it to do something in your day-to-day language, and it will produce new content really quickly. It can produce texts, it can produce images, videos, music, software code. So if we think about it in the context of Pedagogzilla, we could ask it to produce a learning design for a 3-month course on AI ethics aimed at higher education students, and it would just roll that out for us. And then we might look at it and think, oh, yeah, we should have given it more detailed instructions. We rewrite the instructions. It comes out with something else. And there we've got a course. And then we might say, oh, well, but we probably need a video on step 3 of this. Can you generate me a video about this particular subject? It can do that as well. So like the broom, like the magical broom, looks like a wonderful helper. The trouble is, people like Mickey tend not to pay that much attention to the output. So sometimes it will go badly wrong. Generative AI doesn't really understand the world. It just understands what's likely to come next in a sentence, broadly speaking. So we run into the problem where bad work is put out into the world and that begins to multiply. So, for example, there's a big problem at the moment with academic journals where people have put in citations which have been hallucinated by generative AI. Other people have copied those citations, and there are now papers which have never been written, which are racking up sort of 40, 50, 60 citations. So we see this tool getting out of hand partly because we don't know how to deal with it, partly because it's not quite the right tool for the job, many reasons like that.
That's been my experience of it, using it to, I was actually trying to crunch some numbers and it calculated them completely wrong. It actually was making up data. And I knew that generative AI, I did know that it would make up some things, but it never occurred to me that if it couldn't work out what data you wanted it to calculate with, it would just make it up. And I ended up doing it all again myself, which A, it defeats the point of the whole piece of work, and B, I was just so shocked that it would do that. And it was only that I kind of looked the data, the calculations a bit more closely and thought, that doesn't look right. But a lot of people wouldn't have done that. A lot of people would have just said, brilliant, it's done it all for me. What's my next task?
I think a space that I've been sort of looking at with this, I mean, I use it in when I think about digital accessibility compliance, and obviously within the learning design space, Olivia's going to be like, she's managed to get it in. I can always talk about legislation. when we think about things like the PS bar, the web content accessibility guidelines within public sector, within the private sector, the European Accessibility Act, there's obviously things that we've got to meet in terms of standards within the learning design space to make things fully accessible for compliance, but also ethically, it's the right thing for us to be doing. And so I use it for things like generating maybe more complex text alternatives for images that are very complicated, but you still have to make sure that what it is pulling out is the information that you want the student or the person to take away from that image. So it might just pull the things that it thinks are important from a graph when actually the content that surrounds that isn't focusing on that. So it's really like important for us to be, that's where that human role comes back in again, making sure that it may have saved you some time in just pulling that text out and sort of pulling out the highlights, but is it actually talking to what you want it to when you're trying to get a message across? So I find that really interesting. And the other thing is that so there's an organisation called CAST, and they have created the Universal Design for Learning model, and they've been looking a lot into the AI space, and they've sort of reframed some of it as assistive intelligence, which I found quite interesting. And they're sort of looking at it in a way that it is this assistive tool in the same way that we have assistive technology. And you wouldn't just use assistive technology and let it go out on its own to speak for you, but you might use it to support you in trying to get a message across. And they're trying to sort of frame it in that way too, using it as a tool to support us with how we want to present something potentially.
Brilliant. Okay. I think that's covered all of the basics. So yeah, we've talked about what the Sorcerer's Apprentice is. We've covered quite a lot about AI and how it's maybe useful to use it and maybe why it's not. So let's answer the question in the second part of the show, which is coming up now. It's a really bad segue.
Part two, the answer.
So talking about AI then, and talking about what the problem that Mickey had in Fantasia, let's focus specifically then on learning design and how learning design can help with that. So how would an AI learning design have helped the Sorcerer's Apprentice? Anybody want to kick off answering that?
I think there's some principles behind learning design which we can apply here. So I would expect most learning designers, if they're offered a new tool, if they're offered some new content, that they'd take a look at it, they'd discuss it with their colleagues, they'd think about where it works, they'd think about where it doesn't work. So they're doing the work perhaps on behalf of the whole educator team to think about, well, what can we do with generative AI and where might we go wrong with it? And I think one of the things that helps with that is something that learning designers always do, which is put learners at the centre. Think about what the learners are going to gain and what the learners are going to lose from this. So I think these are things which absolutely didn't happen in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. The Sorcerer obviously hasn't thought about how this might be used by Mickey. He hasn't discussed it with Mickey. He hasn't really perceived good practice, and he hasn't really thought about how this might help Mickey or how it might disbenefit Mickey. So he's given Mickey a tool which looks as if it could easily be done by magic, and then hasn't helped him to do that.
Isn't there a stage before that, which is, I mean, this is one of the things I'd like to do in learning design when I'm talking to people, is if we're putting students at the centre and looking at developing their skills, is there a point at which we have to look at the curriculum and say, this skill is no longer a valuable skill? Then why is the sorcerer getting Mickey to mop the floor when a broom could do it very easily himself? Now, I'm sure there might be a valid reason why he's doing that, learning self-discipline or learning how to mop or something. But the question I would be asking is, why is this now a skill that you're teaching when the machinery, the magic, can do it instead?
I think that's a really good point, the point around when you think of AI and sort of developing the tool. And something that I think could be a concern at the moment is that people are using these tools but not understanding what's happening in the background. So say they've used it to create something, but then there's something wrong with it. They can't then fix what has been created because they don't know how it has been created. And so, as you say, if we can pull that right back to understand the tool, what the tool can do, what it can't do, the things that are issues with it. I think the problem at the moment is that it's sort of being seen as a bit of a magical shortcut, to think of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Mm-hmm. And people may be using it out of desperation, or they're using it as a sort of quick fix to sort of do things. But the learning, as you say, needs to shift before that so that we understand the tool that we are using to create things.
So we've got a kind of outline of the skills that the students need and learning about AI. I guess once we've identified what that sort of stuff is, would the next stage be looking at assessment and how assessment's modified? Does that change?
I think generative AI has changed how we think about assessment hugely, because unless you are doing an exam in a room with no technology, there is always the possibility that a student has just fed your question into generative AI and whatever it comes up with, they put down as the answer. And we found out quite early on that some professional exams in America, you could feed their questions into generative AI and it could produce a really high score on those tests. So we've had to really think about, well, what is it that we're testing here? And how can we test it in a way that we know people aren't just pressing a button and giving you the answer that you're looking for? So it's good to be aware of the capabilities of generative AI, but you want your students to be able to go beyond those.
I guess, is there also a case to be made for, as part of using AI in learning design, is to include guidance for students on exactly that topic and what the expectations are for them around, and implications actually, of using AI as part of their assessment.
And we also run into trouble with the marking, because there's certainly been examples of people who are doing assessments running things through a sort of AI checker and saying, oh no, this replicates work which is already available, but not necessarily understanding how the checker works. So if, for example, you're doing a piece on literature and you're including a lot of quotes, generative AI will have those quotes within its database. And so they'll begin to show up as, oh yes, this is produced by generative AI, rather than actually it was originally produced by Shakespeare and it's just been fed into ChatGPT. And you're also seeing it in this essay. So there's lots of pitfalls around this.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the authentic assessment piece and how that's where we can bring that in, so that we're not just sort of asking just a question and then asking people to write something about it necessarily. What are our students going to be doing when they get past the stage of graduation, and what's going to be useful for them? And so if that is, depending on the subject, it might be that AI is going to take a real pivotal role in the job that they're going to be doing. So I think it's about considering that when we're having the learning design conversations, so that we can use AI in a meaningful way within the content and within the assessment space, rather than just sort of maybe trying to think, okay, so everyone's using AI, so we need to try and squash AI in here in some way. So it's trying to just think of it in a more pedagogical, purposeful place.
And I think we're seeing this particularly in programming education, because you can get generative AI to write code. And in a large amount of cases, it'll write really useful code that does exactly what you want. And that is a real temptation for students, I think. To solve a problem, you know, before you'd spend a lot of time, you know, on the internet looking at Stack Overflow, trying to work out how to do something. You know, how much easier is it to just type that into generative AI and get the answer, and then to think, well, I can carry on doing this throughout my professional life. And then what you get is a lot of programmers who just don't understand what is going on, or what they're producing, what they're sharing with people, and then can't solve problems. So if it starts doing something completely crazy, like Mickey's broom, they don't know how to stop it. They don't know how to put it right.
I think for me, I'm trying to think of different quotes people have said, because that's all I've got is a few glib quotes. But one of them was something along the lines of, it's really good for automating or doing the boring stuff that you already know how to do. But if you can just say to it, write me a program, or do this mathematical calculation, or derive this formula, and you never have to know how to do that again, then why are you teaching people to do this and then assessing their ability to do it? You might as well, it's just like testing their ability to, I don't know, do flint napping, I think is the go-to example there.
I think another example is the calculator.
Yeah.
So when calculators first came in, there was this huge dilemma about what you did with them in schools. And some schools were going, well, you know, you shouldn't have a calculator at all. And other schools were going, well, they're always going to have a calculator in life, so why would they not have a calculator in school? So it's knowing what you need to teach people so they can move to the next stage, and so that they know how to sense check things, so that if the calculator, for some bizarre reason, told them 2 and 2 equals 5, they'd go, that's wrong. Perhaps I'll go and change the battery. And we've actually seen this reproduced with generative AI, because, of course, generative AI is really good at completing things that it's seen before. So if you ask generative AI, what is 2 plus 2? Well, it's got a million examples of people saying 2 plus 2 is 4, so it tells you it's 4. But if you ask it, what is 2,895 multiplied by 68, it's never seen that before. So it might get it right, or it might just generate a likely looking answer. And if you've no way of checking that.
Yeah, like, yeah. Olivia's thing. I mean, you know, it's only because Olivia knows the maths that she could see that AI had generated data that was completely nonsensical. And so you need those levels of skills in order to actually use it effectively.
Something that I was thinking about is this visibility piece of the sorcerer. So when we're thinking about the assessment and the whole conversation that we just had around things being incorrect, and actually I think there's a soft skill area that we aren't necessarily doing a great job of in the sector, just in the sense of building up the students' soft skills that they don't have in the same way that we would have had even sort of 15 years ago. Because they are using their smartphones all the time, they're not necessarily communicating in the same ways. And just being able to go up to a person and ask the question, oh, this has come up on my calculator, is this correct? I'm not sure whether that is necessarily happening in spaces, and I don't know why exactly that is, but I think that because technology is so easy to have now, people are more likely to turn to things like AI to ask the question. So I wonder if there's a piece in education around the communication of speaking to each other in these spaces, rather than just the first port of call always being to turn to technology to do a search, to ask the internet. There's also the issue around whether that information's right, but being able to have conversations like the one we're having now, having a discussion about things, is just a really good space to learn.
And I think what's even more worrying is that people tend to trust the stuff generated by AI when they do a search than they do actual people. It's like, you know, one of the ways that people, climate change denial, one of the ways that people are addressing that, and one of the things that's helped, is that if people do a search who are climate change deniers and do a search asking AI about it, they will believe the response from AI, but more than they will a climate scientist, because they perceive it as being less biased, not more biased, or intrinsically biased by the people who've programmed it.
We've touched on this earlier, to think about not just the skills which we don't need to teach students anymore, but the skills which we do need to teach them. Right. And some of those are specifically to do with how they use ChatGPT well. So things like prompt engineering, learning how to give it the instructions which produce what you need. But also really the critical thinking, the understanding of what counts as knowledge and what counts as truth, and how we verify that. So that's going quite deep into sort of ontological, epistemological issues. And I think we really need to be ramping those up in what we include in our learning design, really at every level, so that people are thinking about, okay, AI has given me this, where's it got it from? And is it reliable? Can I verify it in any other way?
There's also a critical pedagogy thing, which is a precursor to all of this, which is, why are you here at university anyway? Why are you getting AI to do it instead of learning about it? Because I mean, maybe it's a bit idealistic, but I'm doing an MA at the moment in philosophy, and it's because I want to understand philosophy in a way that I haven't understood it before. And so for me, getting AI to write the essay would completely remove the point of doing the degree at all. I'm definitely not in the same space that a lot of students, traditional students, would be. But there's still that question of what is it that you are avoiding about education? What is it you're not getting about the point of education that you want to offload it all onto something else that's going to do it for you, when the value on it is doing it yourself? Or is that naive?
I think there's just a point around the experience of learning that I think is, as you say, so if they're just going to go and use AI anyway, then it's building that experience of learning, the role of the teacher, the role of the classroom, the role of the VLE, all of those spaces, to make it the full experience. So it's a real journey while they are studying. I think because we can't deny the fact that AI is happening and it is going to happen and people are going to use it in the workplace, in their studies. So it's trying to make the whole experience worthwhile.
And maybe there's a case for building more reflection into learning so that students can actually think about why they're doing this and putting their learning into their own context.
If we pull back from the learners for a moment and we think about the learning designers, because the temptations for learning designers are pretty much the same as the temptations for students. You know, it does look as if you could get generative AI to do a huge amount of work for you. And so part of that is being aware of where the pitfalls are. You know, how do you ensure that you are drawing on verified sources? And I think coming back to Alice's points about sort of inclusion and equity, one of the problems we have with generative AI is pulling on things which were on the internet in the first place. And those things tend to be in English. They tend to be American-centric or certainly English-speaking part of the world-centric. And it tends, like Mickey Mouse's broom, to reproduce things and magnify things. So if you start off with the idea that if you say doctor, you mean a white male, then you get lots of AI images of white male doctors, and they feed generative AI further, and it becomes more and more and more convinced that all doctors are white males. And it also becomes more and more convinced that English is the way to go because, you know, there's a terribly small stock of material in certain languages. And so their perspectives, all their knowledge gets marginalized. So one of the things as learning designers is to think about the designs that are being produced, the images that are being produced, the texts which are being drawn on, and to try to steer your design away from the direction generative AI is pulling you in and keep in or add that diversity, that inclusion, that equity.
I wonder if there's a way to subvert it by forcing it or prompting it to generate content that isn't the kind of content it would automatically produce. I haven't ever tried that, but I like the idea of it.
Like a Minority Report sort of. Okay, so yes. here's your first run at it. Now, give me everything that you haven't included in this particular perspective. That would be really interesting. Yeah. I mean, on the plus side, looking at sources for the dissertation I'm writing and things like that, I'm not just limited now to English because I can find something that's written in Russian or whatever and get it reasonably translated, so at least I can understand it as well as I can understand anything written in English in philosophy. So I think it's widening things a little bit, but maybe we need to push it, like Olivia said, into looking at that sort of stuff. Okay, well, we'll move on. There's one more thing I wanted to talk about specifically, which is, does the role of AI in education, does that raise more concerns about equality and equity? And we've talked about diversity a bit and representation. Is it making it more unequal? Because I'm thinking maybe some students don't have access to the same AI models, so therefore they're going to be disadvantaged. Is that something we need to look at as learning designers as well?
Yes, I think so. I think it's something that it's a big area that is an issue, and it's not just the same access to maybe thinking about things like licenses to the tools. It's also around things like bandwidth, and if we're building these things in, it's for our students, but also for the learning designers, learning technologists that are being asked to maybe use these tools to create content as well. And it might be that you have got a long-term issue that's with access to technology. It might be that you've got an issue for a week. It might be that on that day when you're trying to do something, you have got a power cut in the area and you can't access. And obviously that affects more than just access to AI, but it's something that if we're relying more heavily on people being able to access these tools, we're not just talking about people who have got specific needs. This is sort of across the board for everyone, really. There could be potential issues that have to be thought of in the design process so that people can still get the learning that they need.
So do we have an answer to our question? How would learning design have helped the Sorcerer's Apprentice to avoid getting swamped by all that sort of stuff?
Well, I guess we have to think of apprenticeship as one of the major learning models across the world. So it's certainly something which should have learning design incorporated within it. It's very difficult to tell from this clip whether the Sorcerer actually has a larger program of training for Mickey or whether he just wants a servant. But certainly we'd expect him to have, for example, gone through basic lab safety. That's the sort of thing that would be at the beginning of training for many. If you're working on a, say, an engineering degree apprenticeship, you wouldn't just let the apprentices loose in the lab by themselves. You'd be going through all sorts of things. I remember when my kids were doing design technology at school, they spent about an hour learning scissor safety. And they found this so funny that they came home and spent a lot of time telling me about scissor safety and, you know, you mustn't run around with scissors. And we knew that. Yeah, and he might have been made aware of why he had been asked to do this mopping when it could be done more easily in another fashion, what he might be going to gain from it. Or he might have been told, you know, this is a precursor to learning about how we do it with magic, and then you can appreciate the difference and what we've gained with magic and what we've lost with magic. So I think a learning design would definitely have helped.
Olivia, Alice, is there anything you would want to comment there?
My initial response was no, I don't think an AI learning design would have helped the Sorcerer's Apprentice avoid being swamped by workplace tasks on the basis that my own experience of AI is that it is totally chaotic. And I can't imagine with all of the guardrails in place that you could possibly think of that an AI learning design would have helped in the situation in any way whatsoever. But Rebecca, you have just forced me to reflect on my own thinking. And I'm coming around to your point of view.
Okay, so I think we've covered all the key concepts there. We'll talk about tips for your practice in the next section.
Part 3. Practical tips.
So, we've kind of dug into Mickey Mouse and sorcery and brooms and AI and all that sort of stuff. What tips can you present to the listener that can help them with their practice to bring some of this sort of stuff together?
I'd say develop a plan for use of AI with your colleagues. You've read about it, you've discussed it, you've used it in other contexts. Think about how it is going to be positively used by your learning design team and what advice you're going to give to the people you're working with. You probably need to put safeguards in place about its use. You need to check that everybody is drawing on verified sources. And I'd say you need to think about how you co-design with AI, not just handing over responsibility to it, not just saying, well, we're never ever going to use it, but think about how it can be used positively with you and your fellow learning designers.
I think you've covered quite a lot of that there, Rebecca. And actually, I was just thinking about things like scaling up, and if things are going to be scaled, then making sure that you're happy with it before you do that. So rather than sort of creating something or pushing something out using AI as a process, checking that it's using everything that you want it to and it's going to produce what you want it to before you scale that out. For example, if you create a custom GPT and then say, copy this, but then you find that there's an issue with it later on, it's already become multiple brooms. So building that in. But also just remembering that, going back to the music analogy, that music starts off as a as something on a page, and actually it's people that bring that to life. So trying to think of AI as this maybe something that is on a page, it is a tool, but we need to be centered within whatever we do as humans so that we can make sure it is dynamic and expressive, but in the way that we want it to be.
So that thing about human centered and human dynamic, I think that's, for me, that would be my starting point, is AI can take on so many tasks, but there's so many that it can't do. And I think one of the essential things, this involvement with AI and everything we do as an assistive tool, and I really like that idea of AI assistive technology rather than something that does stuff for us, is we've got to start rethinking about what it is that humans can do that AI can't, and leaning more into that in our teaching. So actually stripping it right back to basics, which is, okay, I teach philosophy, if I did. What is philosophy now if AI can do the whole bit of trawling through pages and pages of Heidegger or something and converting that into English I can understand? Or if it's maths or programming, if I can just set AI to do a programming task, then what is it that I'm bringing to the equation as a human being, not just as me as a learner, but what does that mean now for us as people? And I think you've got to be prepared to rethink not just how do I assess or how do I create content, but what is my subject discipline now that AI is around, and how will that change in the future as AI gets more proficient? And try and rethink it in terms of what is the human element, what is the human dynamic that makes my subject discipline still worthwhile. And if the answer to that is actually AI can do all of that, it's, well, get another job then, because I don't think there's much point in carrying on what you're doing if all you're doing is teaching people what to do, what AI can do way, way quicker and way, way more competently. But maybe that's a step too far. Olivia, is there something you wanted to come in on as well?
I was going to say, damn you, Mark, you just said exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, will you say it as well and then we don't have to?
well, I was thinking that, I know we think of AI as a quick fix, but it does present a lot of opportunities for, I guess, rethinking what we do. And it does present us with, yeah, opportunities to think about what we can learn from it. It certainly provoked a lot of my own thinking just using it recently as to, I guess, my own practice and how I marry up how I feel about AI from a kind of ethical point of view with the way it is going. I need to think quite carefully about finding a way to use it that I feel comfortable with. I think that's where I've landed with this.
And then helping your learners think through that ethical process to come up with whatever is important for them, I think,
yeah.
Yes.
I think that I'd really like to see more of that. I'd like to see, you know, as you say, AI is here, but is there an opportunity for us as learning designers to provide students with opportunities to reflect on it themselves and the implications of using AI for themselves and for the rest of the world and the communities that they work with?
I think for me, something that has helped me with those sort of ethical issues that I have, there's a couple of things. So the first thing I would say, in my space at least, is the impact that AI can have to support students that have got different needs. So there's a lot of work there that means that learning designers that maybe didn't understand how to do things in an accessible way previously, there's things that can support them as a tool to make the content that they're creating more accessible, therefore making it more equitable for students in those spaces that maybe are using assistive technology. There's things like the checkers and using it to create transcripts. There's things that mean that there is some real good that's coming out of it. So that really helps me when I think about those ethical dilemmas that I've got. And the other piece for me is the sustainability piece. And what I try to do personally is for every use of AI that I do, I try and do something in a different space that's going to sort of offset that. So it might be deleting a load of really old emails or going and doing something in the garden or, you know, trying to, and it, that's not going to change the world, me on my own, but I know that I'm trying to sort of give back to the sustainability piece when I'm using these tools.
Right, before we sort of sign off everything, is there any way that people can get in touch with you or anything you want to promote about what you're doing, or how can people find you if they're interested in more of your thoughts?
They can find me on Blue Sky under Rebecca F, with the first E being a figure 3.
I'm only on LinkedIn these days, and I think I'm the only one. Only Olivia Rowland.
Oh, okay. That's good to know. That's easier to track down. Alice, anything?
Yes, you can find me on LinkedIn as well. Okay. You should be able to find me, Alice Chapman.
Okay. Well, thank you all. It just remains for me to say goodbye to everyone. So goodbye. Thanks for listening. And look out for the book chapter when this gets turned into a book chapter. Yes. So, we are Pedagodzilla. You can find us on pedagodzilla.com. You can find us on, there's a whole range of things, but I'll just drop in what Mike usually just says for rounding things up now so that we hear from Mike, and because he's so much more professional at this than I am.
You can subscribe to us on all of your favourite apps, feeds, iTunes, and at our website, www.pedagodzilla.com, where there's not just a podcast, there's also a book. In the meantime, we love you lots, and we'll see you next time on Pedagodzilla.
Okay, but from now, that's bye from me.
Goodbye from me.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from me.
Bye.